Welcome to the Nature Reliance Podcast, where we explore the history and practical experience of the great outdoors and discover new ways to connect with nature. I'm Craig Cottle, your guide through the fascinating world of natural living and survival skills through experiential education and interviews. Today's episode is brought to you by the Nature Reliance School Online Membership, an immersive online learning experience designed for outdoor enthusiasts just like you. Are you passionate about the outdoors? Do you crave more knowledge about disaster readiness, wilderness survival, bushcraft, tracking, and nature awareness? If so, the Nature Reliance School Online Membership is your gateway to a community of like-minded individuals, all dedicated to learning and sharing essential outdoor skills. With the Nature Reliance School Online Membership, you get exclusive access to a wealth of resources, including expert-led tutorials, interactive webinars, and a library of engaging courses, downloadable books, and documents. Whether you're a beginner or an experienced outdoorsman, there's always something new to learn. So don't wait. Click on the link below to join the Nature Reliance School Online Membership today. Embrace the wilderness, enhance your skills, and become part of a community that values nature as much as you do. Now, let's dive into today's episode. This is Craig Cottle, Director of Nature Reliance School. Got another interview for you, this time with Joe Flowers. I think I've interviewed him like three, four, five times now. I don't know how many times, but it's always good to talk to Joe. He's fantastic. And this time we talk about a subject that I'm really interested in discussing with multiple people, actually. That is the topic of lineage as it relates to survival training. We get into all kinds of stuff. We get into the weeds talking about survival stuff and bushcraft and all the things that go along with it. And Joe tells us a whole lot about the Bushcraft Symposium that he's leading, guiding, directing, making it happen. He's the man. So Joe's always a good interview. So hope you enjoy it. Hey, Joe. How you doing, brother?
Doing well. Thanks for having me back, Craig.
Yeah, man. It's always good to talk to somebody who likes to talk.
Yeah, it makes your job easier.
Yeah, it does. It does. Sometimes I get some folks on here and it's like, you know, trying to get blood out of a turnip, and I don't have to do that with you at all.
No. And I will work on that, Craig. I've been scarcely reminded at Blade Show, reminded how much I talk. Lose your voice within like a day.
Yeah, that's a telltale sign right there, my friend, that you're a talker. But that's okay. Yeah. Blade Show's for that kind of stuff, though, right?
Talking,
right. And, yeah.
You know, the hardest thing was going to the very first Global Bushcraft Symposium, which was a day after Blade Show. So I went straight from Blade Show and flew up to Canada, and man, you know, I'm 39 now. It's like, I'm starting to feel, I know that everybody says that's young, but it's like, no, it's the point where you start feeling old and it sucks. The flight hurt me, but no voice meeting all these important people.
That's the main reason I want to get you on. I want to talk about several things, but let's start with bluegrass. Good gravy.
I'm in the bluegrass area, though.
I don't know why I said bluegrass.
We have a fiddler's convention.
I'm from the bluegrass state, right?
Oh, so perfect.
Let's talk about the Bushcraft Symposium first. Let's go for it. Tell me what that's all about.
Ah, okay. So the Global Bushcraft Symposium, like back in the day, at least before my time really understanding survival, like Lars Fault and Ray Mears and all these astute individuals of the survival world in Europe, had like a quick summit. And in 2019, there's a mastermind from Georgia named Chris Noble, who used to be on the forums and all that stuff too, and Dave Delafield, and they got together and were like, we want to have another symposium, but we want to make it like the first one of a thing here and try and get people, the people who really teach or the people who really know, all together under one roof. And it's not invite only. I think at the very beginning one, everybody was like, oh, we couldn't come. I was like, no, you can go. Anybody from any aspect of anywhere in the world of bushcraft can just go on and buy a ticket to come to this beautiful gathering of people from all over the world to talk about bushcraft. We have people from Sweden. We had people from the United States, all over the world, just come together and talk. And of course, this one was like one of the last times I saw Moritz Kahansky alive. And if your viewers don't know, he's like one of the godfathers of bushcraft in North America, up in Canada. He's like one of the guys I think, kind of responsible for starting the mora knife craze in Canada.
Sure. Yeah, I interviewed him right before that.
Oh,
that
excellent.
symposium. I interviewed him for the purpose of talking Woo. About the symposium.
That's right.
So
I
we
forgot
got
about
him on.
that.
And that was, you know, I mean, it's kind of, I'll be honest with you, man. It's kind of hard to get a guy like that on to know what to talk about.
Yeah.
There's
Well,
so
with
much.
Morris, he just talks. So you're
Yeah.
fine. He's like
And he
me.
did. And he did. But I did. I took the opportunity to pick his brain about teaching specifically, how to get
Yeah.
information to other people, because, you know, that's what I do. So he was incredibly generous in offering that, as well as, you know, I hope we got some people up there for you guys.
Yeah.
And that's another reason I wanted to do it. This one is to get more people to this one.
Yeah, so the first one was in Alberta, Canada. We had some incredible speakers like Paul Kirtley, Lisa Fenton, David Halliday, Desert Dave from the Utah area. Everybody loves was up there. He was up there with Les Stroud, who was one of the main speakers too. And they were jamming and having like
Nice.
a awesome session. And of course, Les Stroud loves to perform because he's a natural performer and also a great survival artist, I would say, because he does all his own editing. But yeah, so that was like this huge conglomeration. And I tell you what, Craig, it was so humbling to meet all of these people and all these different hardcore levels of areas I never even thought about.
Nice.
So,
Like what? What I mean? What do you mean? What kind of?
like, you know, I met Teresa Camper, who is an excellent, I think she's a PhD, brain tanner from,
Yeah, her and Doug taught a class together
yeah,
recently,
yeah,
didn't
yeah,
they? Down at Earth
yeah,
School. Yeah.
exactly. And she taught me all about how you can really make fish skin resilient. And of
Oh,
course,
okay.
you know, I want to make some fish skin kydex sheaths or something like that. And, there were people from Scotland showing us a whole bunch of different dances that night. And then of course, everybody comes together and BSs and tells all these stories. And so there are like aspects along that line. I did a white birch bark, sheath making class. And, then we did a really cool knife making class, where, Bushcraft Danmark showed us how to make, knife handles for like mora handle knives. And we would wedge them, like with a little piece of hardwood on each side. And sure enough, it would hold really hard. And so I asked him, hey, can I start doing that in the jungle? Cause we have all this awesome jungle wood. And so it became a tradition there, you know, stemmed from Bushcraft Danmark. So there've been a lot of connections that I got to make. I was asked to come back on the board for the 2022 Global Bushcraft Symposium in England. We got some pretty big headliners this time. Cody Lundin, from the US is coming. Of course, Paul Kirtley and Lisa Fenton are the, organizers of this. I'm coming there. Honestly, guys, let's be frank. I'm a knife guy, so I can help with giveaways big time and make it rain, knives, which is always fun. And so we got some awesome, groups, down there. We got giveaways like LT Wright has 10 giveaways, Topps knives, Condor Tool Knife. There's going to be lots of knife giveaways, a lot of other gears, areas, but man, I've never been to England before. Have you?
I've never been to England.
Yeah.
I've never been out of the country. I was scheduled to go teach up in Canada to some interesting fellas, military fellas, and it just fell apart, fell apart, man. That was pre-COVID though. So,
yeah. Well, you know, with my company, Bushcraft Global, you'd think I'd be like some sort of like savant, you know, traveling, but I only like started traveling like in my late 20s. I never really did it with my parents or anything either, but I'm glad my wife has promoted or pushed me to try more traveling.
So tell me about the symposium itself. I mean, is it primarily getting the opportunity to sit at the feet of these guys, telling guys and gals selling stuff, or are there physical classes? Are you saying that birch bark class is something that you taught or something you attended?
I taught, of course, a machete class. There are theme camp setups. For instance, Julia Kautoff, who's an excellent Swedish, axe maker, formerly the president of Wetterlings. Now she molds, these beautiful axe handles. She'll have a class like that. There's different people showing, you know, different aspects of some of the areas where they've come from. Of course, I'm doing another jungle bushcraft and machete anomalies class. And so it's kind of like for an area for someone like us, to where it's not just like, oh, this is how you hold a knife. They, you know, these are guys who are like showing you from all their areas where stuff happens. So there's theme camps. There's main speaker talks, and nothing else happens during that. The main speaker talks, so you have a chance to go to them. Paul Kirtley gave a fascinating talk at the Global Bushcraft Symposium 2019 that really honestly changed my whole mode of business. I could thank him for being a bit more successful now.
Was like business practices in this community or what happened?
Oh man,
it was just
Paul, if you're listening, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the talk. I think it was the State of Bushcraft.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it was like an all-encompassing thing. I can send you some videos of it afterwards.
Oh, I'd love to hear that. Yeah.
And then during that whole time, there's a really important time where you're able to go make connections with people. And kind of just go, oh wow, that's how Poland does it, or you know, someone like that. And it's really cool, at least for me, to be able to learn from that aspect. So all these people are coming from everywhere, in like an area where they don't have to worry about camping, although some people love to camp there. They have bunks set up in this beautiful place, and normally they have it near a water source, so they can teach like poling canoes and advanced canoe rescues and things like that. So there's a whole aspect of survival, search and rescue, primitive skills, kind of like more or less, you know, the different areas where, you know, bushcraft comes from. Schloid, if I say that right, you know, carving and all of this stuff too. So it's like the people who really, really, really work really hard at pushing bushcraft. Everybody, like I said, is invited. But a lot of the guys who have been to the first one know how important it is to go, so they can, like Les. I brought him to that. Les, and I introduced Les to LT Wright. And they're kind of, you know, working on some projects now.
Right.
At Global Bushcraft 2019, I met my, what I call my guide, more or less my medic, Peter, who you might have met at some of the things too. I met him there, and he's coming with me to England. Peter right now is working with YouTubers down in the jungle this second on more projects that we're working on. And I wouldn't have met him had it not been at Global Bushcraft Symposium.
Right. I love these opportunities to meet folks like that. That's one of the things I enjoyed about our time down there in Georgia together too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think this is something that needs to be promoted more. I think that small group compared to, you know, a large international symposium, one of the things that I get out of it is that, yes, we're all in a very similar field, and we mm-hmm. could view one another as competitors, if you will.
Right.
But there's absolutely no reason to do that.
You know,
I mean, I just don't understand that, man. I just don't get that.
That's a really, really interesting point. Because I really like that, because you know who else told me that? Ethan Becker of Becker Knives, who's one of my very, very close friends. In the knife industry, everybody thinks there's competition, and some people do push it that way. But there's like a huge camaraderie in the knife world, because people know that people are thirsty for getting more. You know, nobody just buys one knife. Nobody just buys one thing. For instance, I've never taken any tracking courses. I've just learned stuff from the people who we'll probably talk about here in the future. But I'd love to take one of your tracking courses. I'm not going to get into tracking, but now I'm like, wow, I need to go get some extracurricular knowledge so I can apply some other people's, you know, opinions with stuff. And I have no problem going, man, I want to take tracking courses here. I want to do a pole canoe class there, because there's stuff to learn from everybody. And that's, I don't know, Craig, that's kind of what we got into this for, because we like it.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey, guys and gals, a quick break in our episode to talk about a game changer in outdoor cooking, the Fire Maple Backpacking and Camping Stove System. Whether you're hiking, fishing, or even prepping for emergencies, this portable pot and jet burner is a must-have in your gear. Best part? It's nearly half the price of a comparable Jetboil stove system. Thanks to its leading heat exchange technology, you'll experience reduced boiling times by up to 30% compared to traditional stoves, even in windy conditions. That means more time enjoying the outdoors and less time cooking. Are you ready to upgrade your outdoor cooking game? Click the link in the description now to grab yours. Trust me, your outdoor adventures will never be the same.
Yeah, I mean, there was a we had a SEER class this past weekend, and one of the guys that was in class has been a student of ours for about 2 years now, off and on, and he lives far away, and he dutifully listens. Hey, Gavin, if you're listening, I know you are. He dutifully listens to the podcast, and he got connected with Tim Smith up in Maine.
Yeah. Hey, Peter Magnan trained with that's the biggest thing on his resume, guys. Tim Smith, like, invented like bushcraft, like, as a big thing in like the 90s. And he got there. He was cool before bushcraft was cool.
Right. And Gavin wrote me. He said, man, I just listened to this podcast. I think I want to go up there. Do you recommend me?
Yes.
I said, yes, I do recommend you go up there.
I tell Gavin, hey, man, let me know, because I was thinking about that's the pole class I want to take.
He's taking one of his long-term things, man. He's going to be up there for like 3 months or something. And I guess that's what I'm talking about. I mean, sure. Okay. Let's look at it from just purely a business perspective.
Right.
Going up there and spending money with Tim probably keeps him coming from classes with us.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Right.
I don't. I mean, I think it's good. I think people need to get the broad range of understanding it. I don't understand Maine. That's why I like interviewing people that go to the jungle like you, because I don't understand the jungle. I don't understand Maine.
You know, I really appreciate it too. I know nothing about Maine. People were telling me about boundary water canoeing, and it just sounded like a different world. And it's kind of incredible, you know, to think that we could do that. And in the boundary waters, that's still in the US. Don't even have to speak Spanish. And Tim Smith, though, guys, we're going to be talking about people who have taught you some stuff. I never really hung out with Tim except at Wood Smoke. But when I started my jungle experiences, I'm like, Tim, me and my partner are butting heads on like actually sitting down and doing, you know, like classes versus the experiential expedition part. And he goes, okay, well, Joe, let me tell you how we do it with the canoe stuff, for instance. They're learning while they're going. And I really, really adapted that. And I really appreciate him doing that. So, you know, Tim,
I'll tell you how I got connected. Let me tell you how I got connected with Tim, because this is just a statement about the community as a group, as a whole, and him as a particular individual, in case he's listening, because I like saying good things about people.
Yeah.
Is I got an email from him one day, and I had followed him, and I reckon at that point, because I didn't realize this, he had followed me for a while. Mm-hmm. And I just liked his content, and sometimes I might comment, sometimes I wouldn't. I'm just, I guess, as bad as everybody else, just ghosting, I guess. And I get an email. I mean, just a direct email. Craig, this is Tim Smith from, you know, up here in Maine. I just want to let you know, I really like your podcast. I'm learning a lot from it. Everything's going really well. And I just absolutely enjoy the way you interview people.
Yeah.
And I mean, he didn't have to do that. You know what I'm saying? He didn't have to take the time to write me and say that and just encourage me like that. And I thought, this is the kind of guy. And so I had him on a podcast, you know, a couple weeks or a month later. I mean, he's just that kind of guy.
He's a great individual. By the way, guys, shameless plug, since we're talking about him, he has his own podcast that's been going on for a long time. And it's great because he's pretty, he'll say it too, trying to get him out all the time is really hard. So it's just when they feel like it, which may keep some of the pressure away, but it's Jack Mountain Bushcraft. And that's his school.
It's another one I listen to. There's, man, I'm making podcasts and teaching classes, and I can't make myself listen to stuff just sitting around the house. I can't either.
I have to be in the car.
I want to be working or driving.
Yeah.
I mean, working in the garage, fixing something. And
exactly.
He's one of those that I listen to, because I like listening to him too. I guess that brings us to where I wanted to get to as well.
Sure.
I want to talk about Blade, but let's come back to that in a minute. One of the specific things we said we'd get on here and talk about is lineage.
Oh, yes. Yes.
What does that word mean to you? And would you care to talk to us about the people that have taught you?
Sure. Well, like, I don't know, to me, everything needs a foundation to start on. You know, when you're building Legos as a little kid, you have to start with a block somewhere. And, you know, there's tons of books we can get into that, you know, inspired a lot of people, even when they went to Barnes and Noble, you know, getting these books. And I always had like a very book, especially when there's pictures, because, you know, reading, but book-based bringing. And I was at Barnes and Noble's, I believe, in like at the very beginning of college, and I see this book called Practicing Primitive. And I'm like, what is this book? And I'm like looking it up, and it's blowing my mind. And then I see.
So you hadn't done stuff like this before this book, you're saying?
No, really? I did. My very first class, I guess the only like real class, was in high school with Richard Cleveland, who's still
the
around.
First class I ever went to outside of my family. The first time I ever took a formal class was with Richard.
Oh my gosh, we got to get him on here. I don't think he even remembers me. I was just some annoying kid who never shut up about knives, which really hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed to me.
Yep. But he has the Earth School in North Carolina. I took like a 3-day class with him, was smitten. Yeah, I found Practicing Primitive maybe about a year later, found out it was at Scheele Museum. And I got to meet Stephen Watts, probably one of the most influential people, you know, in my life besides my family. Stephen M. Watts was an archaeologist at the Scheele Museum. He's responsible for Wilson. You know, between him, Dave Westcott, and David Halliday, all three of them were both on, all three of them were consultants on the movie Castaway. Steve's talking to the director, and he's like, well, Tom over there is going to need a little bit of survival of the head. And they were on Tiburon Island, which is this kind of sparsely inhabited island off of the, I believe, the Yucatan Peninsula. You guys can Google it later. And they found like a volleyball, stuffed it full of seaweed, and put some, like, I don't know what, some kind of gross, whatever the primitive paint that they can make quickly on the island, which I'm sure David Halliday knows right away, and made like a really trashy looking Wilson. And of course, the props department took that design and made it like a multi-million dollar icon of cinematic history. And Steve said,
so they made that on the fly while they were filming.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Steve said, last time you saw the original Wilson, it was being kicked down the beach by like 6 different indigenous kids as a ball.
That's awesome.
So yeah. And he had, this was right up my alley for school. Cause he was only like 2 hours away from me, and they'd have like weekend classes that were perfect. So I could study, go snake hunting, and then go to these classes. And it was just the shortest amount of time for me to do some of these projects. But I really, you know, had a good relationship with Steve. We'd sit there for hours and talk about knives. But he was at this phase where he went from, I don't know, Craig, like primitive skills into classic camping. And I hit him, or I started learning with him right at the junction of that point. And that's where I got to meet awesome people like Doug Meyer, who's a dear close friend, and he's just an incredible academic, even though he doesn't call himself that. But
he's, you know, teaching, he's teaching here next, this coming weekend.
Yeah.
When you're listening, it'll probably be after Doug's been here, but he's coming up this weekend to teach blowguns and Native American call making.
Yeah. Yeah, Doug is, he teaches me something like every other sentence. Doug is such a wealth of information and just a really good note taker too. But yeah, Stephen Watts was kind of where I started, and I hope to be 1/10 as good of a dude as he was. He passed away in 2016, but his lineage is still like very, very, you know, around. He had a very interesting way of teaching where you get excited for like using a crayon for a fire starter, and you'd be like, I'm going to take a whole class about that. And and so that's kind of like where I've got my setup. I went up to Morris Kahansky's place in Canada, but I didn't necessarily take a lot of like classes under him. We just spent time, you know, one-on-one interviewing and learning and just playing around. So like, you know, I've interviewed and hung out with Morris Kahansky, but I consider like Stephen Watts one of my true teachers. But, you know, it's not just teachers where you get stuff that are like, you know, classic, like primitive skills teachers and stuff. There's people like probably from our background who we know, and they're just good old boys that we learn from as well.
I cannot emphasize that enough, at least from the way I came up and started studying and learning things. I mean, I've said it a few dozen times around people that ask this specific question, but there's a guy named Noy Johnson that literally lived off the land near
me. Wow. Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy that, I mean, don't get me wrong. He lived basically in an old stripping room, part of a barn. And most of the time he just lived out in the woods.
Wow.
And he didn't know the names of anything. He didn't know science at all. Man, did he know the woods.
Yeah.
Like nobody I've ever met in my entire, you know, all the teachers that I've read about, watched interviews with, nobody knew the woods like him. And because he literally lived it was mm-hmm. almost like being with somebody that was like a Daniel Boone type that would go out for years at a time, you know, or, you know, months at a time and stay. And so I learned a lot from him, and nobody knows him. Nobody knows him, and nobody will know him. I mean, he died, and it's just one of those guys that he lived a hard life and knew how to share information about the hills, you know. And my mom's family were moonshiners in Tennessee, still are moonshiners in Tennessee. And so they knew how to hide and stay away and keep things, you know, moonshine in Tennessee. Yeah. And so there were things that I learned just by going to family reunions with those guys that it was just like, all right, why is this built like this back here in the hills? And well, it's because of this, and, you know, yeah, just because
we had a distillery up here.
And then period correct reenacting is what I did growing up as a kid.
Yeah. Steve Watts was into that too.
Yeah, we did. You know, I spent a lot of time at TPs. I worked at Fort Boonesboro State Park for a short while, making flint and steel fires for tourists, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's just how I started learning. You know, I was fortunate to have parents, particularly my dad and my mm-hmm. uncles, his brothers, that were all into period correct reenacting. And wow. Heck, man, we stayed in caves for a couple of years. We went to stay 1 month out of every month, we went and stayed in a cave.
Oh my gosh. To have like reenacting family as like your heritage. I can't imagine the buku stuff you'd learn, Craig.
Oh man. Yeah. That's stuff that I talked about down in Georgia, Joe.
Yeah.
That was fascinating to people, and I'm glad. I actually just wrote an article for Jim Cobb's magazine about the same subject, but it was that kind of stuff is just.
Which magazine? Cobb.
Backwoods Survival Guide.
That's not Backwoodsman. That's Backwoods Survival Guide. Okay, yeah, cool.
Two different ones, very similar names. But though the stuff, I mean, I didn't prep for that, Joe. I know you know how this works. I didn't have to prep for that. I just grabbed stuff and just started talking about it. And people were fascinated, man, which I love.
Yeah, I got to start doing that too, instead of worrying about all my PowerPoints and things.
A time for both, I think, particularly if you're an educator. I mean, there's a time for both, but that's one of them subjects that sometimes it might take me a day to research and study and write the article the way it needs to be. And there's sometimes I'll just write an article in 2 hours and I'm done, like that one.
Oh,
you know,
man,
I mean, because it's just there.
Yeah. And you know that there's always these guys who like really do it. Cause I mean, let's face it. Sometimes we're stuck, especially me, I'm stuck behind a computer talking about stuff rather than just out there doing it. And these doers, whether it be the indigenous in the jungle or a Maine trapper, or you know, somebody's reenacting, they're the ones doing it, and they know from real experience. So it's awesome to sit there and watch them too. I had a I still do. I know him very well. There's this Gullah speaking man who's just like a
Good old, is that a language?
It's an African slave language, more or less. That's very popular, like in the Low South area. So it's kind of like a Creole. Basin, you guys, I'm not doing the history justice with this. You can look up Gullah speaking individuals, and you can't understand a word coming out of his mouth until you really get to know him. Cause you know, I've known him ever since I was a kid, but he's the one who taught me, you know, how to prep snapping turtles, which I've only done like twice, and, you know, how to hunt squirrels very, very well. And he, you know, could skin them faster and I could even look at it. I'd like turn over and there's like six done before I'm even like started. And she's like, gosh, how do you do this, Moses? But he's still like, you know, he can't read very well, but he can fix almost any engine in like 20 seconds and do all of this amazing stuff. And there's just a rich heritage that I think can help you, you know, just like the Lloyd, the person you spoke of.
Lloyd Johnson, yeah.
Lloyd Johnson. Like,
tell me if really you think this sounds right, Joe. I mean, mm-hmm. I was listening to a podcast this week about the idea of theory versus practice, and the person that was, it was basically a motivational speech by David Goggins is who it was. I don't know if you knew who David Goggins was. He was in Army Special Forces, Navy SEAL. He's a guy that runs, 200 miles and stuff like that. But anyway, his comments on theory versus practice, he's talking about mindset development and how you can do hard things if you got the right mindset.
Right, right.
And the thing that he expanded upon is that there's a lot of people who have theory,
mm-hmm.
which are academics, and there's nothing wrong with that. But those people haven't been there, done that.
Right.
In his words. And there's a huge difference of theory versus practice, kind of going along with what you, or I feel like it was kind of going along with what you were saying. Do you feel like it's an adequate way to describe it?
It's definitely it. I mean, I honestly, I'm a horrible, horrible, carver and craftsman and to the point where, my business partner down in, Columbia loves to make fun of me about it. And it's very, very accurate. I live up to it. It's fine. But I watch the guys who are the dudes who really do it and can explain, what they're doing a little bit more to help me. And I've gotten better just from that, even though I still can't do a great spoon or can't flint nap except to get an edge, for worth the life of me. But, these guys who just do it all the time, you can see it in their hands. You can see it in the way they walk. You can see, it's just such an appreciation for any skill set, guys. This isn't even just in bushcraft or survival. I mean, you can see this between people talking about stained glass and then the guys who make the mosaics that are just jaw dropping, who are really humble.
Yeah. Do you happen to know Johnny Faulkner from my part of the world up here?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
So Johnny was an archaeologist for the Daniel Boone National Forest. I'll tell you, this will explain why what you're saying is just on point. Is that he was an archaeologist for Daniel Boone National Forest, which extends from northern down to southern Kentucky into Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically, in the last few years of his career, and he's a really good friend of Doug Myers, by the way.
Yeah, of course. I think I know of him from.
Yeah, from Living Archaeological Weekend. He's the one that set that up here in the Red River
Gorge. Ah, okay, cool.
So
that's context. Got it.
Yeah, he documented basically petroglyphs and a lot of other stuff that were happening in these rock shelters by native peoples back when. And he made a presentation that I went to, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And I wrote him yesterday and I said, "Hey, Johnny, is that presentation anywhere where I could see it again? I've got a friend that's asking me about it and I wouldn't mind seeing it again too. Is it recorded or did you publish anything on it or anything of that nature?" Cause he's that kind of guy that's, he's like, "Man, I don't do that." And I was like, "Well, I was just," he said, "What's your interest?" And I said, "I just want to study petroglyphs in my area of the world again." He said, "Well, come up." He said, "Bring your buddy and we'll come up and I'll show you how they did it. And we'll do it. We'll make one." And I'm like, obviously, okay. Yeah. Thank you. And that is the kind of guy that I want around me. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He could have wrote up a paper on this because he spent a lifetime doing these things. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have put that on the internet and he could have just sent me a link, but he would rather, "Hey, Craig," because I know he's got that information. He could give it to me in an internet link. I know he's got it, but he would rather me just come to his house and me do that with him.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? These guys are just, they're worth so much information, money, what, I don't know how else to describe them. They're just invaluable.
Yeah. And you can only gain just a little bit. I mean, books, I've got hundreds of books. Books are very important, but when you have somebody teaching and professing you and doing it right in front of you, you get to learn so much more. You can't learn this stuff just by sleeping on a book through osmosis or whatever. You have to get out there and do it. And I think sometimes, as instructors and stuff, it's more fun doing that. Cause I mean, a lot of times people just teach bushcraft and don't have a chance to like actually do it. So they're like, "Yeah, come up and we'll try and bust out a 4-foot friction fire," or something along that line. They just need the excuse or the push to do it. And that's what kind of makes it fun. Well, let's try it,
Yeah, I agree 100%. Well, who else? Who else has been there for you?
Doug, honestly.
Yeah, he's a good one, isn't
he? Yeah, Doug makes something primitive almost every single day, if not every single day. And just hanging out with them, I learned different ways of doing like reverse wrap stuff that I end up forgetting and have to be reminded of, or just seeing some of the methods where he's able to do things, and it's neat trying to translate those to the tribes and see what they do and be, "Oh, they do that, but with their foot," or something, and So, you know, having him there, and then, you know, there's a lot of, you know, really, really important people that, you know, I don't get a chance to hang out with much, but like David Westcott, he's been, very instrumental in the
whole
world.
Now, do you go
world.
Out to Rabbit Stick?
No, I've been out to Woodsmoke. I've tried to go to Rabbit Stick almost every single year and end up having to do something. I just have to like block it out. But yeah, Rabbit Stick sounds awesome. And he has these giant, it's inspiring to me because he has these giant, conglomerations of people from all over who have like a Geo Metro, and they live out of their teepee with the teepee on top of their Geo Metro, all the way to some like overlander and stuff too. And just like, you know, like, the person with the Geo Metro and the teepee, you know, these guys don't have time to go behind a computer and talk about how awesome they are. So there are these gentlemen that have come to rendezvous all throughout the, you know, the MEPS thing up in, I think, Kentucky or Falling Leaves down in Georgia, you know, primitiveskills.org, the Rabbit Stick and some of these other places. There's just such a meeting year after year where you get to see some of these incredible people. And you know, that's just so amazing. But David Westcott also is really good at doing research. And, you know, he was in Larry Dean Olson's book. If you look at like the young guy in there, that's David Westcott. And that's like Outdoor Survival Skills. The book was one of like the foundations for some of my teaching too, by Larry Dean Olson. And, you know, Westcott was a big part of that book.
Sure. I think, well, was it me and you or me? And no, it was me and Doug. We got in a discussion about something related to that book that I'll pass on discussing right now, but, sure. But it was, I've got like the second version of it.
Ah, okay.
I think one of the older, you know, one of the older versions, one of the good ones, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the good ones. And that's, man, that's a fantastic book. And it's, I mean, today that kind of information is in books nearly all over the place by a host of different instructors.
Oh yeah.
And these guys that were I don't know that I want to call them the pioneers, because they're basing their information on the actual frontiersmen and settlers and pioneers, but still. Man, to put a book together when none of that information was
out there
readily available is impressive.
And have you seen Westcott's book, Camping in the Old Style?
I don't know if I have that one. I don't think
as a reenactor, you would love it, because it just covers all of the old style camping. And the first edition is great. The second one is even better because it has the A Corps patrol that used to reenact classic camping. So the early 1920s, the golden age of camping, as Stephen Watts and David Westcott like to say, because there were more people, more or less, and this isn't exact, but more or less per population camping then there are today. Well, this was pre-COVID, until everybody got the bug to go outside, you know. But yeah, and Westcott's done an excellent job summarizing that information, and there's just so many cool old school photos there.
Yep, I wrote that one down. I'll be getting that.
It's a cool book. It's hardcover.
Man, these interviews always do this. Everybody blames me for getting more books, and I blame you for getting more books. Everybody that I interview is always saying one more book that I've got to get. That's awesome.
Well, the Theory Versus Practice by Dave, what's his name? Goggins.
Oh, that's not a book. That was a podcast.
Podcast.
But look him up. He's got a good book. He's got a good book, but that dude's not a human. That dude's a robot.
Oh man.
It's incredible, man. You want to, I think, you know, I'm a big fan of trying to teach, not trying, but I do teaching mindset development, how to overcome hurdles, how to overcome your mind. Cause your mind's typically the things that stops you doing most things. Mm-hmm. And he is one of the best in the world at teaching that sort of stuff. I mean, he's, cause he's done some things that are just, I don't know. He's a robot. I mean, I don't want to run 200 miles, but that guy can run 200 miles and tell me what it's like, you know?
Oh, man, there is a guy just like that in the entomology academia area, not zoology, everything. He's still around, Carl von Hernsrick, and he's like a long distance runner that also deals with like thermoregulation of animals. So he's like crazy. Yeah, he's crazy about like survival.
Did you
aspects
say entomology or?
He does everything.
Zoology, both. Okay.
Because he has a really, really good book. I actually first listened to an audiobook about ravens, where he studied the biology of ravens.
Can you but spell that last name? Van
Hernsricks. H-E-I-N I'll have to look it up because it's, you know, a different, I believe, okay, German.
I could probably find it from that.
Anyway, thermoregulation, ravens, the winter, what happens to animals in wintertime, what happens to animals in summertime. And the first book that you can find, this one I've really nerded out on, is called The Thermal Warriors. And if you go and look up the book, The Thermal Warriors, that's how to spell his name. Sorry.
Okay, that's
Dr.
fine. Dr.
Heinrichs.
That's what I needed. Awesome.
Thermal Warriors, though, is kind of nerd level bugs, so you might not be interested in that audience. His Raven book is incredible, though. But just like one of these robot guys, he's like, I'm going to run 200 miles an hour and then write a book, man, and then do a podcast. And then,
yeah. Yeah. They're like you. They got boundless energy.
Yeah. But they've got boundless focus, though. That'd be nice. But some of those guys, you know, just with that level, you're like, gosh, if I could get to that level in survival theory, you know, right, it's incredible. And the mindset that you're working on, too, you know, write a book on it.
Yeah. I got one that's got 5 chapters on it, but I have considered writing a whole book on it. I've got other projects I got to get off the ground.
Yeah, right now. I got to go year after year. Oh, you want to go to Trinidad next year, Joe?
Yeah.
So hey, if you want to have a subject podcast, about time management, let me know. I'll be all ears.
All right. Tell me about books, man. We were going to talk about books, I think.
Books, hey, are
for everybody listening. Usually I have a pretty laid out organizational plan on podcasts so that we stay controlled, but me and Joe decided to wing this one.
Yeah. It's that easy. We're already probably 45 minutes in.
Yeah, we are 45 minutes in. That's
perfect.
Tell me about books though.
So everybody, you know,
I've got a surprise for you, by the way.
All right. I can't wait. I'll try and fast forward it then not talk.
No. But, go ahead, please.
Books, you know, Stephen Watts always professed different books that I really got into. Of course, Horace Kephart, some of the original, you know, founding fathers of the wood skills that actually got into writing. There's some outlier books out there that I had, of course, all ready to go, that are really, really weird, that I just enjoy and have a rant that people should focus much more on. Probably one of my favorites is Shelters, Shacks, and Shanties.
I've got that book.
Oh, gosh.
That is a great book. Doug Myers is the one that told me about that book.
Yes. Oh, man. Is that by Beard or Mason? I can't remember.
I have no idea, man. I just know which one you're
talking about. Shelters, Shacks, and Shanties.
And I got it. It's so cram-packed full of stuff, dude.
Yeah. It's the one I just keep going back to, and it's dog tired. And it's one of those ones where there's the old woodcuts of like all these different Boy Scout, you know, shelters.
You're
like, oh, man, there's an underground shelter set up in there. And it's like looking at the back of Boys Life magazine and seeing all these cool ideas. But like in the 1920s, it's just, or earlier, it's just a fascinating, fascinating book.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And then there is a really weird one that Morris Kahansky actually recommended. And you want to talk about books. That dude had books.
Yeah.
Craig, like 250,000.
Get out of here.
No, I think there were more. I'm not kidding.
Oh my gosh,
he had like
dude,
5 different buildings full of books. This guy loved and read books like crazy.
Tell me, what happens with that sort of thing? Does a museum get that, or does a library get that? How does that? His students?
I think his kids took care of it. His kids and some of the guys close up there, and they'll do a good job making sure it's disseminated. But I honestly don't know. You know, when Steve passed away, Doug Meyer got most of his books.
Yeah. Me and Doug have talked about this subject. And Doug is out of the one have talked about doing a podcast on lineage. I know we kind of got into it a little bit, but I guess that's what I wanted to get at is it's these guys that are these legends. I want to know, I've never intended on wanting to be a legend or even known for that matter, but I do want to know how they got to the level of knowledge, and all of them read a lot.
Yeah.
All of them.
I'm collecting books a lot, but I'm not reading them. Doug actually reads them.
Yeah. I think that's part of the issue. I think a lot of people do that. You know, I've had people that will bring my book to me to sign, and you can tell it's never been opened up.
Right. Right.
And I'm happy to sign a book. For those that are listening, it's not that it bothers me, but I would rather people read them than not buy them and put them on the shelf. So I think it's something I like to encourage people to do.
I'm trying to force myself to have like a 2 hour or 3 hour a week, just like turn off my phone and my computer and go into that room, lock myself in when my kids let me, and, you know, read like that. And sometimes, you know,
hey, do you listen to books on tape? I mean, like
all
Audible?
The time.
I've gotten into that, man. And I was hesitant to go that route, 'cause I was like, I don't want to go that far with technology. Right.
Right.
But I've really enjoyed buying books on, you know, like Kindle.
Yeah. You know,
they're just easy to carry around.
If we're talking about, you know, books and some of the ones that have been influential, there's one that's on audio called Deep Survival by Lawrence Gonzalez.
Oh, I love that book, dude.
Oh, dude, that's a great one to listen to on audio. Book. Dude, yeah. And I probably wouldn't have gone from start to finish with a tangible book with that one, with that style, because you could surf around in that style. But as an audio book, as a method of learning, at least for me, it helps really well, which is probably why I don't listen to enough podcasts, because I'm too busy listening to audiobooks.
Right. That's me too.
Tony Nestor's got audiobooks out. Heinrichs is his name. Now it finally came back. B-E-R-N-D. Heinrichs, the gentleman who does the thermoregulation temperature research. He has the winter, a book on the winter and a book on the summer that are fascinating.
Again, that's focused on insects.
No, zoology in general. So okay. Like what a bear actually goes through in the South versus a bear up there, like really random stuff that gives you that level of knowledge to where you almost want to be done pumping the gas to jump back in the car. Like there's like an antifreeze content of snapping turtles that are up north that the ones in the South don't have. So they're able to tolerate freezing temperatures and go into a state of like complete, you know, suspended animation versus the ones in the same species. And it's really cool because he does a really good job. And sometimes, you know, driving up to Kentucky, I want to kill about 5 hours and you can do it quick with audiobooks.
Right. Yeah, easy.
But then I'm just going to say this. There's I'll go ahead and say it on the podcast. Yeah. For me personally, just my opinion, I could not listen to Kephart's book on audio because the people who would read it would read like all of his recipes and it'd be like, the next 12-day expedition would be as follows, 5 pounds of bannock. And it would go through and like list the whole thing. So some but cases
it got a little slow.
Yeah. Sometimes you'd have to fast forward through those parts, but
I got a book, a book called Tough by a fellow named Greg Everett. Okay. Definitely one of the top five, probably one of my top three books about development of how to be tough. I don't know how else to say it. I mean,
yeah.
This guy takes mindset and physical development to another level. And he happened to come to class this past weekend.
Wow.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
For your book, were you just like, oh my gosh, yeah. What do I do?
Oh yeah, dude. Yeah, it was fantastic. But to go back to what you were saying, I told him, I said, Greg, I love your book. But you are the driest dude to ever read your book that I could imagine. And I said, I'd listen to it because I like the information, but you're terrible. You're terrible. And he said, I know, man. He said, my wife tells me that all the time.
Yeah.
But the information, I don't think there's a book out there that has information that is distilled in such a way that it's as useful as what he put into about that particular subject.
That's
not
incredible.
Necessarily survival related right. at all, really. It's not bushcraft. It's not that, but it is. It's definitely survival. Man, it's a good one.
I tell you, I have one and I've wrote that down. It's called Tough. And I'll get this from maybe, do you have like podcast notes when you put these up or anything?
Yeah.
I'll send you the links to at least the ones that I've.
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
And do that. So, but the one, and we will. Not my number one rule, especially with other anybody in bushcraft or survival, is not talk about martial arts because we'll just kill like another 5 hours.
Right.
Everybody has a black belt.
Hey, that'll be the next podcast.
Oh gosh, I won't do that here. it's like my rule, but there's a book. Here we go. Called Warrior Speed, and it's about being faster and having faster reactions. And mine is dog tired. And still, even though I don't own my own dojo anymore, I still read it a lot because not only is the information presented in such a way that makes it, at least to me, having a scientific background, it's like academically he's really citing all his sources, but he talks about a lot of different things that are way more important than just, you know, learning how to dodge a jab or something. You're able to see, use peripheral vision to see critters on the ground easier and to make snap decisions and things. And it talks about, you know, like actual techniques, you know, and some are very weird, but the development of it, you know, really, really makes, really helped me be better. I don't know, in the bush, you know, it taught me how to see better, to be faster. You know, you might not necessarily be wired like a hardcore MMA, you know, like a fighter, but, you know, like I'll be able to see, you know, like, okay, my hammock tarp's about to come down. I could get up there and grab it real quick before it happened because I saw it better, you know, faster. And that kind of, when you're aware of some of those small little tips, that's all you have to be, is aware of them to practice them more.
Man, I've got a question for you since you brought this up. Maybe this is not the time to do this one, but
oh, no worries.
I think that there is an incredible connection between people who enjoy martial arts and people who enjoy survival and bushcraft.
There has to be, because I haven't met one non-black belt yet.
If I ask this question around the campfire, how many of y'all have ever done martial arts? If there's 20 people there, there's a minimum of 12 or 13 of them who have.
Yeah.
It's not all of them, but it's definitely over half almost every time. And a lot of times it'll be up 80, 90%.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, other than what you just described, because I think they both inform one another. I think martial arts and training helps inform you about outdoor training, and outdoor training helps you inform your martial arts.
Yeah.
But there's just an incredible connection between those two subjects, I think.
Yeah. You know, it's really, really, you know, obvious out there, especially with the, you know, big blow up of MMA since the early 90s and stuff. But like everybody seems to have like, you know, some BOSAF knowledge where they want to use sticks. And then all of a sudden they're starting playing around when they're at a bushcraft event. Or, you know, for you, the Filipino Chamonix design has a little bit of knife fighting background in it, I believe.
It does.
And, you know, there's just such a correlation, you know, between using your hands and your feet, of course, and being able to manipulate the environment around you. And sometimes it's with the knife where you're using and making a tool, or sometimes it's somebody else's face that got too close to your face and you have to, I don't know, manipulate it. And I think maybe that aspect of knowing more about how and be self-reliant has its core values and some of the reasons why people start a self-reliance course, a nature reliance course, or learn self-defense. I mean, he's got a lot of these, the words, they're right there in front of you. Self-reliance, self, you know, defense, all that stuff too.
I think self-defense isn't a must-have understanding for to be self-reliant.
Right, right.
If not, you're relying upon the police department. And as all the guys that I've trained in the years have said, you know, over and over and over again, is when seconds matter, the police are only minutes away.
Right, right.
I mean, these are the guys that are police officers. You know, these are the guys that are telling me that, hey, you need to be able to take care of your own safety and self-defense.
Hey, you know what? I've got a huge rant on this, and I'm going to go grab the thing because it's right over there. So you can pause. Sorry, Trace. Okay. You can pause the editing and I'll be right back. Only take a second, though.
Yeah, that's fine. Go ahead, man.
Okay, back. So there is this whole level of self-defense that I'll try and keep this rant very, very short. What you guys might not see on the podcast is basically just a very long, like 4-foot club. It kind of looks like red oak or something, but if you held it, it's ridiculously heavy. And it actually is kind of like a half circle shape with a flat end, but it's just basically a club. If you guys just imagine a club, and this is used for bashing heads by a tribe called the head bashers, actually called the Kurubo, although they don't call themselves something else. They're uncontacted. Half of them now are contacted within the past 4 years and are actually interested in working on some of the same stuff with me, with Bushcraft Global. But there's a lot of hard stuff you have to do there, but they're called the head bashers because they all have basically a bow staff or a bow door or something.
So this is a walking stick that they carry with them.
No, they carry it for bashing things.
And that's it.
That's it. It's their martial arts weapon.
All the time.
All the time. And it has to be up to each, chin level. And, yeah. And so this is their martial arts weapon that they've acclimated to jungle life. And it's very, very interesting. And so there's a bushcraft aspect that's been taken to self-defense and is also kind of like all of those aspects together. And, you know, they use this for hunting too. And you have to be good at swinging a stick if you've taken karate or doing a tournament or you're an indigenous in South America.
Right.
That's and fantastic. I'm going to pause one more time because somebody is pounding on the door.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, man. Tracy, no, no I can't believe that. I know you're not Tracy, but Tracy's going to have to hear this.
Yeah, I know. That's no problem, second. Man.
Never fails, Craig.
Neighbor girls wanting to play with my five-year-old, and that's why it sounded like orangutans were out there.
That's fine.
So there's this aspect when you have a blade, you should probably know how to use it in case you're in a personal situation. But knowing how to use a stick, it's one of the most primordial things that we could do, whether you're, I don't know, making a fire or using it as a weapon or, I don't know, stabbing a vampire. Yeah. So I think that all resonates.
I've gotten away from doing martial arts on a regular basis. I think I've told you too. I used to run a dojo too for, that's what I did for a living for about 16 years, but
of course,
but one of the things that we use, it was Japanese based martial arts. So we had, you know, Joe staff and
yeah, I've yeah. gotten the to short 5 foot one, never mm-hmm. the shorter one. Yeah.
I've gotten to where I carry that now again. And that's most of my, cause I ruck every morning. I hike every morning for about a mm-hmm. mile or two.
Excellent.
And so nature study and just getting outdoors kind of thing.
Right.
But I've gotten to where I'm carrying it more often again. Just, I don't know. I used to just smash people with it, but now it was originally a walking stick that people learned to smash with rather than
exactly
what basically how I've come around full circle with it really. And it works good for that. Just walking.
The best part about a walking stick, and Steve Watts actually taught me this during a walking stick class, mm-hmm. whole context all coming together, is when you have that walking stick with you, it's a third way to touch the world and know what's going on around you. And it's not only going to help you, especially me with my knee, which is why I had to stop my dojo. It helps you have stability. It helps you prod stuff to find out more about it. And it's just something to keep on you at all times for self-defense when you're walking and rucking. Keep a dog away from you. If it's a bad doggy, you know, you've got a something to keep you that far away versus that close. And then when
have you ever studied anything with the lion trackers from Africa? Have you ever read any text or anything about those guys?
No, but Doug's trying to, Doug keeps telling me about these guys and how they're doing all sorts of large pachyderm tracking and stuff and just, incredible. Why do they carry a stick?
Yeah. There's a book. Do you like tracking, the idea of tracking?
I do big time, which is why I want to learn from you.
All right. So I would love for you to come to class, but you got to get this book, write this one down.
Got it.
This book is The Lion Tracker's Guide to Life by Boyd Vardy.
The Lion Tracker's Boyd Vardy.
Yeah. The Lion Tracker's Guide to Life by Boyd Vardy. One of the NRS regulars told me about it and I didn't get it. I thought, man, that sounded kind of silly. I'm not much into tracking lions. I'm tracking deer and you know, bear and raccoons and stuff here. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it took me about a year to pick it up and I picked it up and listened to it I listened to it on my first trip down to Georgia.
Yes. It's an audiobook. Now we're talking. Yes. I'll kill that one in the day.
And here's what I did, dude. It's not an exceptionally long book. I listened mm-hmm. to it down to Georgia. I listened to half of it on the rest of the way to Georgia. And then listened to the second half and listened to it. I listened to it three times to and from Georgia.
Wow.
It was fantastic. One of the best.
Dang, Craig.
It's definitely one of the top. As far as outdoor books, probably one of the top. It is definitely one of the top three, maybe the top one or two books that have been influential to me in the outdoors.
Well, folks, I guess what I know what I'm listening to next.
Yeah, get it, dude. It's good. But one of the things that comes out of that is that one of the tools that they carry with them is a little stick, and it's a little 2.5 to 3 foot, not even 3 foot long stick that has. It's almost like a Native American war club.
Oh, okay.
And because they typically had a ball on the end of them or some variation.
Exactly.
And the way they used that was if they're at some of the traditional tribesmen, if they got attacked before firearms were available, mm-hmm. they would shove that down the throat of the lion to get them off of them.
Okay. And I got to try that with the gator.
That's what they did. I mean, so back when these guys were, the only way they could get food is when a lion killed something. and they would run in and cut off meat from it and then run back out. If they got attacked, they would shove the stick down the lion's throat.
Dude, this is a whole nother level of human nature I've never even encountered. Dude,
you've got to get this book, man. It's fantastic. I mean, and that's not really why the book is good. It's just part of it.
No, I want to hear about that. I'll read the whole book, man, just for that.
Oh, it's fantastic.
You know, those guys are the doers. You know, we're in martial arts, you know, we're sitting there teaching, you know, different forms of how to, you know, do stuff with the bow staff. But they're like, no, you just shove it in throat of animal attacking and then be done. Go get more meat. Oh, that's so weird.
It blows my mind, dude.
But, you know, there weird context with that. You know, I took and I'd be happy to give you the things, but I took a rabbit stick class from Steve Watts.
Yeah.
And he talked about... Yeah.
Yeah. He's given me out a lot of the material from that class.
And oh, perfect.
We taught a class together. Well, when I say we taught a class, I think he taught 90% of it and I taught 10% of it to a military group. That
because he's awesome.
Well, I mean, it was a primitive skills class and I'm not a primitive skills instructor. He's the man,
yeah, for sure.
So I helped him teach and I taught a little bit of something. I can't remember, but, he taught rabbit stick in that class and basically taught a portion of Steve's material in that class.
Yeah.
Daggone, man, that dude, I know so many people that have been influenced by him. He must have been just an incredible individual all around.
Dude, like I said, we had such great times at class. It became a family, you know, mm-hmm. coming there. And these were only like 3-day classes, but yeah, I really took them to heart. They weren't like three months out in Tim Smith's area, but you know, when you're able to do some of that stuff and have some context, I mean, just throwing a stick. You know, you throw your 5-foot or however long your Joe staff is, and you've got sidearm, you've got 5 feet of clearance, you know, spinning that you won't miss a rabbit as much.
Right.
If you can get that area, and it really has that context. Oddly enough, my herpetology professor said nobody who was studying saltwater crocodiles. Every single one of them, instead of carrying a stick, they had a big screwdriver. He never followed up with
the throat
or
down through the brain.
No, through the unhinged jaw. Apparently he said, I'm not going into it, but every single one of my, saltwater crocodile students has a limp. And I was like, dude,
what?
Yeah. So
get out of here.
Yeah. So do I carry a screwdriver on alligator territory? No, but I could see shoving something in another animal's mouth to get it to stop. I mean, they even say to do that martial arts wise with dogs sometimes so it can't get a clamp as much. They say that. I've never tried it.
You ever been on the other end of a canine like that?
No, that's what I'm kind of got my doubts on.
I have. I mean, you definitely want them to get a hold of something mm-hmm. rather than your throat.
Right.
You
right.
know what I'm saying? But man, a dog that knows how to take you down by grabbing. I've had a dog. I mean, and I'm a big boy, Joe. You've probably noticed that. And I know how to scrap. And I've had canines drag me down the ground, man.
Oh,
I mean,
my gosh.
And with no problem to drag me to the ground.
That's crazy.
They're good at what they do.
I have to. Back in the day, I used to be on with Equipped to Endure. And they had a gentleman there was like a professional dog trainer. I have to get in contact with him because he's here in North Carolina. I need to get on the receiving end of one of those rug suits.
Do it, man.
So I can appreciate it more.
Yeah, I did. I tell you what I did years ago. I taught a week long, I can't remember what it was, survivor man type course for high school, these guys that were getting ready to go to college age and some mm-hmm. that were in college. And we were out for a week and doing all sorts of things and martial arts training and survival training. But one of the things I did is I'm good friends with a lot of local PD because I trained a bunch of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we had a day where they came and they tased me and I got attacked by the dog and we talked grappling and all this stuff.
Oh, cool.
And dude, I'm telling you what, neither one of those things do you want to happen to you getting tased or being taken down by a dog. Man. Just if an officer says, hey, I'm going to put the dog on you, then just whatever that officer's telling you to do, you better do
better
it.
Better do it.
You yes, better sir. Do it now.
I mean, there's people who'd rather be shot than be tased out there.
Oh, it hurts, man. I mean, for the moment, it'll rock your world.
I got nailed by an electric eel.
Oh man.
And and apparently that's the way I got shocked wasn't that bad. because they have to kind of like saunter up to you like a Latin dancer and like put their whole like more surface area of their body on you to have more of a connection to really, really shock you. Mm-hmm. But just enough. I'm like, good gosh, what does it feel like when you get tased? And one of my buddies just bursted out laughing, goes, Joe, you should try it sometime. I want to be there.
Yeah. It
sounds horrible.
It was what I was trying to do is leave an impression upon these young men to, you know, not break the law. And it worked. I still nice. Have those guys on occasion write me and go, Mr. Cottle, I remember when you got tased that time and it scared me to death. You know? Oh, man. Well, Joe, excellent. We're up on an hour, man.
Oh, perfect. This is good timing because, you know, yeah. The neighbor girls are starting to look through the windows right now.
Okay, I'll let you go, man.
Oh, no, it's not your fault. It's just summertime. Hey, yeah. What do you have going up? What classes and where can we find more information about, say, I want to take a tracking class?
We have a tracking class in September. NatureReliance.org is our home for all things that we do. So for those that are listening, jump on there. We've got a lot of agency sponsored work over the next month. So we'll be out of pocket for our civilian coursework. But we'll pick back up hard and heavy in the fall. And my son's getting married.
You mean you have to teach a whole lot of badasses some stuff instead of us normies? No,
I love teaching both. I really do. I love teaching both for different reasons. So
absolutely. You know, hey, congratulations.
Yeah, man. Thank you. I know you're doing some too. It's good to be part of something that you know is going to help change the world. You know what I'm saying? And on both fronts, whether you're teaching bunch of high speed dudes or a bunch of absolutely normal people like me and you. I really love doing both.
Excellent. It really is rewarding. You know, when you teach more, at least for me, which I'm not that great of a teacher, at least in the US, much more when I'm in my environment, but like, it just helps you learn so much more. And I think that's something more has taught me too, but the congratulations was for your son.
Oh yeah. Married,
you just said.
Yeah. He's getting married. So that's big news for us coming up. That's in another month. So we're getting close to that. So I'm the best man.
Oh, congrats.
My son was, he was homeschooled. So he was here all the way for school and then we're self-employed home. So we have a pretty tight family bond. So he asked fantastic. Me, I was very humbled to be asked to be his best man. So I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
You're having a tender moment with Craig Cottle. You're a nature nice one. That's fantastic. I mean, it's all about legacies and that's what it is in the survival world. I mean, even in martial arts and with our kids, you know, legacies are important. So remember where you guys came from.
Yeah, man. Good words, Joe Flowers. Hey, appreciate you, brother.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
I'll let you know when this goes up.
Perfect.
Everybody, thanks for listening in with Joe Flowers of Bushcraft Global, not Bluegrass Global, like I said earlier. Check out the symposium. We'll have links for everything. I don't know if we can get all these book links in there or not, Joe, but I'll do
Global
everything
Bushcraft
I can.
Symposium, Global Bushcraft Symposium 2022.com. You just Google that and you'll find out about it.
All right. I'll make sure there's a hyperlink below so you can just click on it too. So thanks for joining us. Come on, join in. Let's learn together.
And that wraps up another fantastic episode of the Nature Reliance Podcast. I hope today's journey has inspired you to explore and connect with the natural world in new and exciting ways. Before I say goodbye, remember to check out the Nature Reliance School online membership. If today's episode sparked your interest in wilderness skills and outdoor adventures, this online community is the perfect place for you to start or continue your journey. You can currently sign up for a year for only $99 and get 2 months for free. Click the link below to discover a world of expert-led courses, engaging content, and a vibrant community eager to share their knowledge and experiences. Whether you're starting your outdoor journey or looking to deepen your existing skills, the Nature Reliance School online membership is here to guide you. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe for more adventures and share this podcast with your fellow nature enthusiasts. Until next time, come on, join in. Let's learn together.